Hello and welcome to this week's Convex Conversation with me, broadcaster Helen Fospero. Greg Jenner is a public historian, perhaps best known for being chief nerd, as he calls himself, on the award-winning BBC comedy Horrible Histories, and for his hugely successful Radio 4 podcast, You're Dead to Me. His latest book, Dead Famous, has been described by critics as a dazzling, eye-opening and provocative account of the history of celebrity. And I think it's fair to say he's become the Joe Wicks of history during lockdown. Greg, thanks very much for finding time for a chat. New podcast, new book, fancy new home microphone and a new haircut.
Yeah, can you tell? It's front-facing, it's all right. At the back, it's a bit short and lopsided. My wife got a bit carried away with the scissors.
Well, I was interested to know how the back was looking, because from the front, it does look fine, and I can only see the front of you, but I hear it's a little bit different at the back, isn't it?
That's the thing with curly hair. You can get away with quite a lot. I think from the front, it just looks sort of relatively smart, and then the back, Kate was a little bit overeager, so I'm going to stay
front-facing. This is a podcast, hey? Just stay front-facing. So let's start off with you bringing history to life for children during lockdown, because you normally do it for adults who perhaps haven't paid attention in their history lessons, but you've got a great new series for kids, haven't you?
Yeah, it's called Homeschool History, and it's on Radio 4 on Monday mornings and available, of course, on the BBC Sounds podcast. It's only 15 minutes long. They are short, sort of funny lectures, I suppose. That's the one way of describing them. They have comedy sound effects added on for a bit of amusement, because it's primarily aimed at kids. You know, we're looking here at children aged 7 or 8 years old, probably. But it goes out on Radio 4, and Radio 4 have a certain sort of tonal requirement. They're kind of, I think they were slightly alarmed when we were putting poo jokes in, but it's trying to find that perfect balance of a thing that is quite detailed and not patronising and full of information for a very young audience who don't know very much about history, but it's going out on the national broadcaster to several million people who have just listened to Start the Week with Andrew Marr. So there's a sort of odd tonal flip from his dulcet tones towards me then saying, good morning, hello. But it's quite lovely to do, actually. And what we're finding, which is really nice, is that because every episode is co-written with my friends Emma and Gabby, who are both very funny writers. Gabby works with me on Horrible Histories. Emma writes the script for You're Dead to Me. So they're both very funny young women. But every episode is co-written with an expert historian who has a PhD. And so we're actually squeezing lots of really interesting top-level, university-level kind of knowledge into these little 14-minute lectures for 7-year-olds. So we're getting lots of emails and letters and messages from people saying, I didn't know this stuff, and I've been listening to Radio 4 for years, and I didn't know any of this stuff about Pocahontas or about the space race. So I think what we're hoping to do is to try to get kids to enjoy it, obviously. But actually, it feels like maybe we're actually also speaking to grown-ups as well, which is nice.
You're definitely speaking to me, because I've been listening to some of them. Let's get stuck in and have a listen to a clip from one of the episodes starring, among others, William the Conqueror.
Today we are donning our chainmail to explore the almighty scrap that changed Britain forever, the Battle of Hastings. And why was there a battle? Well, it's a long story about who should be King of England. You see, at the start of 1066, the king was an old man called Edward the Confessor, which sounds like he was always admitting to eating the last Jaffa cake.
It was me.
Actually, confessor just means he was very religious. But even if they had Jaffa cakes back then, and they didn't, they would have been pinched off his plate by Godwin, Earl of Wessex, who was Edward's wife's dad. Bolshy Godwin and his Bolshy sons were basically running the kingdom instead of Edward. But in 1051, Edward had lost his patience and booted them out.
Ow! Jaffa cakes. I love the fact you get modern day references into a bit of history there.
Yeah, and also it's, you know, trying to find things that kids are going to laugh at and recognise. So we've done quite a few jokes about, yes, stealing the Jaffa cakes and licking the biscuits, which, you know, you do when you've got a sibling and you don't want them to have the biscuits, so you lick them all.
Well, we've all been there, haven't we?
Yeah, exactly.
How does blending humour with sound effects, you know, facts and farce, work so well with your subject, do you think? Because it really does work well.
It's quite hard to do, actually, because tonally, some of the stuff we're covering in the series is quite sad. It can be quite violent. History is full of, you know, wars and battles. You know, the story of Pocahontas, who we did a few weeks ago, is very, very sad. So the challenge sometimes is to find the levity and the silliness when it's tonally appropriate. And then when you get to a section that's, you know, about violence or about war or about someone's husband being murdered, which is what happened to Pocahontas, you then have to try and find a sound effect that is still enjoyable for a child but doesn't feel facetious or inappropriate. So my producer, Abby, is very good at doing that, and she does some of the voices herself as well. I think she I've definitely heard her a few times doing some of the silly little sound effects. So it's an interesting challenge because you have to be really cognizant of the appropriateness of what you're saying. You know, you can do jokes about people in the past having sort of stupid hair and weird, you know, weird jobs or whatever. But when you're actually talking about violence and death, and certainly in the current climate where there is a lot of sadness on the news, we're not trying to depress or scare children. So that is something we've done, thankfully, for 12 years in Horrible History. So I'm relatively good at it, but you do have to keep an eye on it.
In the Florence Nightingale homeschool episode, you managed to slip a little thank you into the NHS at the end. I thought that was really lovely.
Yeah, it had to be done. I mean, we, you know, the reason we chose to do Florence Nightingale is because it was her bicentenary, 200 years, obviously a hugely important figure. But of course, also, there's a hospital named after her. We are going through an extraordinary crisis, and healthcare workers, doctors, nurses, carers are incredibly brave and courageous, and they are doing their job without sufficient PPE, and they are putting themselves in danger every day. So it felt like the minimum we could do was just to say thank you at the end of the episode, because Florence Nightingale is the reason that nursing is the way it is today, really, and so it felt appropriate. And the BBC let us do it, which is very kind of them, so we made sure to squeeze that in.
Before we chat about Horrible Histories and your other podcast, You're Dead to Me, tell us a bit about you, Greg, and how you came to love history so much.
I'm not entirely sure. People ask me this a lot, and it's a really interesting question because I don't think there was a kind of light bulb moment. I really enjoyed it when as a kid growing up. I've always played with little toy knights, like medieval toy knights. They were the toys that I would buy from the toy shop. And my granddad had fought in World War II. He was in the RAF, and I'm half French, so I've got a sort of long, interesting sort of heritage on my mum's side. She'd often sort of joke about the Battle of Agincourt being a minor skirmish of no real importance. So I kind of grew up, I think, aware of history in my family, and I grew up sort of enjoying it as a fun thing. And I loved, there's a very funny sitcom when I was a kid called Maid Marian and Her Merry Men by Tony Robinson. And it was just
say no more.
Really, really funny. The joke was that, you know, Robin Hood was an idiot and it was Maid Marian who was the brains. And it kind of just was one of those things that connected with me. And then growing up, I loved Monty Python. I absolutely adored Eddie Izzard. A lot of my sort of comedy tastes were sort of my dad's taste, I suppose, growing up, Peter Cook and Dudley Moore, the Goons. And they all did jokes about history. So I guess I was just growing up, I found history enjoyable and it made me laugh. And I found it something I could resonate with and relate to. But I think I was going to probably study law at university. I think I changed my mind quite late, probably about 17 or so. I was like, oh, maybe I'll do archaeology and history. So I've come to it with a sort of a furious passion since then. I think since university, I've known I've always, you know, wanted to be a historian. I wanted to be an academic. I couldn't afford my PhD. But as a kid, I think I just liked it. So, yeah, I don't know why.
That's a very good answer, but I mean, how then did you become a public historian? And I've got to be honest with you, I don't really know what a public historian is. I suppose it's time to confess that
now. The problem
with
the job title is the typo on public. Autocorrect very often turns it to pubic historian, and that is a very embarrassing...
That's something very different, isn't it? And just checking, you are a public historian before we go any further.
Definitely public historian. It's an American phrase. It's come across to the UK probably in the past 10 years or so, and I now do a little bit of teaching on the public history master's courses at Royal Holloway and York University, where I studied. But it is an American idea. The idea of public history is that it's reaching out, it's communicating with the general public, it's talking to the public, but it's also listening to the public as well. So it's not just broadcasting one way, here are all the facts you need to know. It's also listening back and saying, well, what do you find interesting? And what family stories have you got? And what community projects are you doing? So my job as a public historian primarily is more sort of interpreting on behalf of the public, making quite complicated historical ideas accessible to people who don't like history. That's my gimmick, I suppose, is that my career is about trying to reach those people who really didn't get on with history at school, or they dropped it as soon as they could, or they've always found it boring or irrelevant or tedious or dull or, you know, of no consequence to them. And I've always thought, well, my job is to find those people and get them to change their minds. And there are other public historians who are fantastic and brilliant at what they do, and they tend to perhaps focus on people who do like history already, and they try to develop their knowledge further. Whereas I'm more about, well, how do I get people who have never even read a history book or never even watched a history documentary? How do I get them to sort of think, oh, history's all right, actually, I don't mind it? So for me, public history is about not being patronising and not being condescending and not sort of standing there and saying, well, you need to know this, it's very important. That's not going to work. I try to use humour, pop culture, funny ideas. I try to sort of find out what people are interested in and then see if there's a history to that. So my new book on the history of celebrity is my attempt to find out, you know, people seem to care a lot about celebrity. It's enormously important in our culture. And so it felt to me like actually this was a subject that people find intrinsically interesting, and yet they probably don't know much about its really interesting deep history and its roots. So that felt like a good opportunity.
And you found some fascinating celebrities from yesteryear, didn't you? And a lot of names that probably most of us would never have heard of. Who were your favourite characters that you discovered when you were writing Dead Famous?
There are 125 celebrities in the book. It took me 4 years to research it, so a huge number of people could have gone in and didn't go in. But I love Clara the Rhino. She was a two-ton celebrity in the 1740s. And she toured Europe for 17 years, and she was literally a kind of rock star figure. And that's obviously surprising because you think, well, how does an animal become a celebrity? But she did. I really love Edmund Kean. He's sort of the star of the book a bit. He's a really brilliant actor in the early 19th century. Comes to fame in 1813, I think it is, 1814. He was a terrible person. Like, he was an awful personality. Awful to his wife, awful to his kid, terrible to his friends. Like an alcoholic, totally chaotic, scandalous, had affairs. In America, his fans tried to kill him. Like 5,000 people stormed the stage to try and murder him in Boston. He was just the worst, but he was also a genius. He was brilliant. He was the greatest actor of the 19th century. And he had this incredible story of going from nobody to the most famous man in the kingdom in the space of a week. He was literally a nobody. Nobody had heard of him. And then a week later, he was the star. So I love his story because it's so counterintuitive. It would make a fantastic movie. So he feels to me like a sort of a good poster boy for the book, really.
Well, you've been getting some cool reviews everywhere from The Times and The Guardian to The Spectator. You've done an audio version of the book too, so shall we dip in?
Certainly.
Both royals and celebs carefully manipulate their image to communicate glamour, health, power, authority, prestige, and uniqueness. They perform their public identities, projecting artfully constructed personas. And the fictions are so dominant and so pervasive that a glimpse of either looking slouchy in sweatpants while picking their nose is a potent image for which we will pay good money. In particular, the celebrity industry deliberately fosters this dichotomy. It elevates the poised, glamorous persona as the apotheosis of allure, so that we are thrilled by the long-range paparazzi snaps of celebs looking tired and frumpy.
I also loved The Sound of the French Dancer from 1895, and you just said that you're half French, so I'm now going to completely cock up on her name. Cléo de Merode, was that right?
Yeah, she's called Cléo de Merode. So she is this gorgeous, very elegant dancer. She danced in Paris. She was famous for her hair initially. She has this long, flowing, sort of Renaissance-style hair. She looks like a pre-Raphaelite a muse, and she was very, very glamorous and elegant. She wasn't even the best dancer in her company, but she was so beautiful. People were obsessed with her, and photographers became obsessed with using her as a model. But strangely enough, she then ended up being incredibly famous for her ears, because people were so curious about what her ears might look like, because her hair was down all the time, and it was so thick and lustrous and curly that people just started to sort of fantasize about what her ears like, and it got attached to her sexuality too. She was rumored to have been having an affair with the King of Belgium, who was called Leopold, and she was called Cléo. So their couple nickname was Cléopold, which I think is rather lovely. So long before we had Bennifer and you know, Jennifer Aniston and Brad Pitt and Angelina, you know, the sort of the idea of portmanteau names of celebrities. Actually, in 1895, you've already got Cleopold. But she toured America, and the Americans were just so hung up on her ears that she eventually lifted up her hair to show a newspaper journalist, and she just had normal ears. And
they were quite unremarkable.
They were totally normal, and everyone was like, "Oh, that's a bit disappointing." And her, it all went wrong for her, really, because there had been this kind of sexual tension about how gorgeous she was, but also her ears were clearly some sort of mystery that she was hiding from people.
I love stories like that. I mean, can you match historical celebrities with modern day ones?
Yeah, it's relatively easy to do from a quite simplistic point of view. You know, a lot of what I do as a historian is try to find those parallels so people can enjoy them. I mean, strictly speaking, the past is very different to the present. And, you know, a lot of what I do as a historian is then to say, actually, 19th century morals and vices and so forth were actually quite different. And let me explain why the 19th century is different. But you can actually sort of say, well, look, there was a kind of Kim Kardashian figure in the late 19th century. It might be Anna Held, for example, who was a French singer. She was a very big star in America, in vaudeville. She was famed for her outfits, for her costumes, but also for her publicity stunts. She and her husband, Florence Ziegfeld, were always putting fake news in the newspapers to boost their reputation, to get their name in the papers. Her husband famously said, "A day without her name in the papers is a bad day." And they did all sorts of fake things that weren't true at all. Sort of stories, you know, there was going to be a gold statue of her in Paris, not true. There was a story that she'd saved a judge from being killed by runaway horses, not true. They planted a story that she bathed in milk to keep young. That wasn't true at all. So all these fake stories built up until the point where, much like Kim Kardashian, she was actually the victim of crime. She earned lots and lots of money, and she had these wonderful jewels, and she also owned her own private train with a sort of luxury bedroom on the train so she could travel around America and tour America. And the jewels were stolen from her train, and because she'd spent so many years telling people these fibs, no one believed her. So she was the celebrity who cried wolf. And the same thing happened to Kim Kardashian in Paris. She was robbed at gunpoint and no one believed her. So there are parallels, and you have Master Betty, who was a child actor in 1803, who was a huge star for about 2 years, and then people got bored of him. But he was 12 years old, and so he was sort of the Macaulay Culkin of the early 19th century. And then you get Shirley Temple doing the same again in the 1930s. So there are quite easily sort of simple parallels you can make between figures from the past and figures now. There are definitely ways to sort of go, well, look, this person's a bit like this person. But history, of course, is more sophisticated than that. When you actually get down to the nuts and bolts of it. But as a way of introducing an idea, it can be quite helpful.
It reminds me of a story. In our family, we've got some Belgian roots on my great-grandmother's side. She had a beautiful business card from donkeys years ago, and it said the Princess of Orange was the name on it.
Mm.
And for a TV programme, we were doing something like, you know, who do you think they are? And we thought that we'd got royal roots. And so I went to Belgium and explored it all and tried to find out, you know, who this relative was, the Princess of Orange. And it turned out she was a total fantasist. And she'd printed the business cards and turned up at royal receptions, and nobody questioned who she was. And she certainly wasn't the Princess of Orange. I think one or two members from the outside of our family didn't speak to me after I revealed that on national television, that destroyed all their dreams of royal connections. David Bowie's death was announced the day you started writing the book, wasn't it? And that was a bit of a game changer, I gather.
Yeah, it was. Pure coincidence. So I got the green light to write the book literally the morning before. So my editor said to me, yep, okay, you're commissioned, you can write this book. So that was January 2016. We'd been talking since August 2015 or so. So I was excited to get going. I came downstairs, sat down on my laptop. I created a little folder on my laptop called Dead Famous, and started sort of noodling on a few little opening ideas. And then my phone beeped and David Bowie had died. And I wasn't a huge Bowie fan. I knew the hits and the classic stuff, but I wasn't particularly upset about it. But I switched on the radio and I looked at Twitter, and everyone was just in mourning. There was a sort of national grief amongst journalists and musicians and actors and creative people that I follow on Twitter. And Lauren Laverne's radio show, I love Lauren, I think she's a brilliant broadcaster, she turned her radio show into a eulogy where her listeners phoned in and texted in to give their own eulogies of this brilliant man who had changed their life. And I realised I'd got celebrity wrong before I'd even started writing the book. I was going to write a bit more like kind of snarky, facetious, cheeky, kind of like, oh, celebs, you know, what are they for? And the power and potency of this man's death, of this great cultural figure having died, and he died so suddenly, and of course he'd released an album 3 days beforehand, so people were totally unexpected, that, you know, they were taken by surprise. And it made me realise that celebrity is much more powerful than I'd given it credit for, has much more of an impact on our lives. It helps us think about who we are as people. Celebrities can be role models, they can be inspirational, they can be people that we enjoy following, they can be people we enjoy mocking and taking the mick out of. You know, it's not always positive, but they also bind us together as a society, and they allow us to have ethical conversations and to talk to strangers, you know, hairdressers and taxi drivers or family members and friends, about the activities of these famous strangers who we treat as almost neighbours, almost friends. And David Bowie's death revealed the power of an individual to change people's life. And so I suddenly thought, I've got this book is going down the wrong path. I haven't started it yet, but I'm already in trouble. Actually, I need to change tack. So very unfortunately, he died. But I suppose it was fortunate for me, from a very selfish point of view, that I could sort of take stock and go, oh, I'm being a bit naughty here. And actually, I need to be much more serious. So Dead Famous is a funny history book. You know, everything I do is meant to be funny, but it takes celebrity very seriously, and it also tries to find why celebrity is so important and why we like it so much.
And has your world changed, Greg, as you've got better known? I mean, presumably when you started out as a public historian, you weren't necessarily thinking you'd be podcasting and you know, being a recognised face. But I suppose has that helped you get your message out and help broaden what you do, because people tune in because they go, oh yeah, it's Greg Jenner's, you know, it's his podcast?
I don't know. It's a very, this makes me feel really
embarrassed,
really sort of like I would hate to be a celebrity. I'd absolutely loathe it, and I'm doing everything I can to not fall into that category, while at the same time trying to do what I do, which unfortunately, by definition, my job is to be public facing and to
yeah, forward facing. I thought we agreed it was
with
forward
my hairstyle,
facing,
you know,
not backwards.
Mangled at the back.
yes.
But my job is to sort of go out and speak to people and to be sort of relatively well known, I suppose. But I really, really don't want to be a celebrity because it's so invasive and scary.
It's quite nice to try and bob below the bar, isn't it, if you can?
Yeah, I'm trying to. So, there, I mean, I talk about in the book the fact that celebrity is different from renown. And so I argue in the book that David Attenborough is not a celebrity. David Attenborough is renowned. He's incredibly famous. He's, you know, a national icon, but he's not a celebrity because we don't know anything about his private life. We don't know where he shops or where he goes on holiday. We don't know who he votes for. We don't know anything about his private life. And celebrity culture is fascinated with the private life. That's one of the crucial elements of it. So there is this sort of parallel track you can run. You can be a very well-respected broadcaster, such as yourself, but hopefully there isn't necessarily, you know, people aren't necessarily camping outside your house trying to find out,
Thank you.
what you've been doing in your private life that week. So I it's nice having a podcast that people enjoy. It's genuinely lovely when I get messages from people saying how much they're enjoying the podcast, and that's really, really lovely, but anything that feels like it's sort of teetering on me being the story rather than the history, that scares me. And then I back away and run away from that.
I'm not surprised. Now, parents across the land are indebted to you for what you brought to the TV series based on Terry Deary's fantastic Horrible Histories books. I mean, you call yourself Chief Nerd, and I certainly don't remember my careers officer offering anything like that. I mean, what did the role entail, Greg, and how did you get it? Because it sounds a dream job for an historian.
It's the best thing I'll ever do. I mean, it's one of the strange things is that I peaked at 25 and I can live to 100 and I'll never top
now.
It. It's all downhill. my career is a downward slope. Yeah, so Terry's books are brilliant. Obviously, they've sold 23 million copies or something. They're an incredible franchise and beloved by people. But in 2008, we decided we would, you know, turn it into a TV comedy sketch show for children. And I was very lucky in that I was just in the building at the time. I was making historical documentaries and historical dramas at the time. So I mentioned already, I couldn't afford my PhD. And so I knew I wanted to carry on with history. And I knew I wanted to help people enjoy history as much as I do. And so television felt like the most obvious place to go because it reaches the most people. So I went into telly and I was making documentaries. And then I moved into making historical dramas, which was really good fun. But I was at a company called Lion Television in 2008, where I'd started out, and I just overheard my boss, Richard, on the phone talking about Horrible Histories. And I'm a very shy person, naturally. I'm very unconfrontational. I have no instincts at all for sort of, you know, going up to strangers and demanding things. But I suddenly got this momentary kind of flush of courage and was like, right, okay, I'm going to have to do this because I need to get this job because I love comedy. You know, history is my absolute passion. Of course, I've dedicated my life to it, but comedy is my sort of great love. And since the age of 13 or 14, I've written comedy, I've watched it, I've performed it a bit. And so I went up to him and said, I need to work on this show. I will do the photocopying, I will make the tea, I'll do whatever you need. I just need to be involved because I'm a historian who loves comedy and you're talking about making a history show that's funny. That's me, please. And I didn't expect him to say yes, but he's a very nice man and he also is quite sensible. And he looked at me and went, oh, you're right, actually, we weren't going to have a historian on the show. We were just going to take the stuff out of Terry's books. But actually, it would be quite useful to have a historian on the show, wouldn't it? So he introduced me to the team. And 2 days later, I had a job. And it was sort of like this bizarre moment because I looked around the table and in front of me was Caroline, my producer. It was a brilliant comedy producer. Dominic Brigstock, this amazing TV director who directed like Alan Partridge and all these great shows I love. And then we had all these comedy writers around the room who had written all the shows that I'd grown up loving. And it was like, oh my goodness, I'm in the room with all these people. I've grown up watching their stuff. And they were all looking at me going, go on then. And that was my job suddenly, was to tell them the history of the world every week for 6 to 8 hours. And we'd do it for 16 weeks. So I suddenly found myself with the most brilliant but challenging job because I was in charge, solely in charge. I was the only historian for the first 5 years. I had to do the entire history of the world every week, and each week would be a different subject. So the Tudors, then it'd be the Romans, then it would be the Saxons, then it would be the Vikings, then it would be World War II, and then it would be the Victorians. And I had to go and find all this funny, fascinating, amazing stuff, make sure it was true, write it up, and then tell the writers how to do it. And then once they then wrote their sketches, I would tell them, no, that's not accurate, you can't do that, that joke doesn't work, that's not fair. So I went from having a pretty straightforward job of making documentaries and dramas to having the most challenging job of my career, probably, but hugely rewarding. And we're still making Horrible Histories, actually. We're on series 9 now, and I now have a large team of historians, and several of them have PhDs. Every one of them has a master's degree minimum. I run a team that is more qualified than any other TV team. You know, we have more specialists working in Horrible Histories than on nature documentaries or anything. It's extraordinary. So we've ended up now with this sort of squad of brilliant young historians who are funny as well. So I get to call myself Chief Nerd because I'm surrounded by the other nerds. But I was a historical consultant. That's my official job title.
And you must have been delighted with the response because, I mean, Horrible Histories was the programme really, wasn't it, that I think probably first turned children onto history in a very different way to perhaps the dry textbooks that exist out there.
Yeah, you know, as I said, it's been probably the best thing I've ever done in my life. And I hugely love doing podcasts. I love writing books. But Horrible Histories genuinely reached something like 60% of all the children in the UK. We have the sort of stats that the BBC compiled at the time. And it was this enormous hit that went beyond kind of children's television. You know, we won comedy awards for grown-up TV. You know, we twice won the best sketch show of the British Comedy Awards, which normally goes to grown-up shows. We've won stupid number of BAFTAs. It's amazing to be working on it. But the best thing for me, the wonderful thing for me, is that we made a show that kids could enjoy as their own, and they felt it was for them. They didn't feel it was patronising. They felt it was designed to let them enjoy this subject. And what's so lovely about it is that we were smuggling in all this fantastic historical research, but because it was silly and they were doing poo jokes and slapstick, they didn't feel like they were learning necessarily. So sort of learning through stealth almost. So our motto on the show is laugh yourself smart. You know, the idea that you're giggling, but actually by the end of it, you suddenly know about, you know, George III. So my favourite ever moment, I think, probably was I was on the tube in London just going to work, and sat opposite me was a small boy and his mum. And I had my headphones in, but he was singing to me. I could see he was singing to me. And I was like, what's he doing? So I took my headphones out. And he was singing one of our songs from Horrible Histories. And he didn't know it was me. It was just clearly a song that he liked to sing. And it's a song from series one. It's the Four Georges. So George the First, Second, Third and Fourth. And they're a boy band and they're on stools. And the first character is George the First, who's German. And so this small boy was sort of singing, I took the throne of England just cause I was Protestant. And the mum just went, oh, not again. And I was.
Did you say anything?
I couldn't say anything because I didn't want to be weird and sort of go that, you know, I helped write that song. But it was this amazing moment where this small boy, who probably couldn't have been older than six, knew that George I was a German Protestant who took the throne of England in the early 1700s. And that is not something that a child should know. And Horrible Histories had smuggled that in. You know, his brain had been conquered by our sort of silly song. And he was enjoying it. And it was like, that's the power of the show. And the extraordinary thing now, the slightly depressing thing now, is now the grey hairs are starting to come. I get to teach at Royal Holloway in York a little bit, a couple of times a year. And about 4 years ago, I started lecturing undergraduates who had grown up watching the show. And now...
Oh, no. And now, does that make you feel
well,
old?
Well, now I know two people who are doing PhDs in history who... grew up on the show, and they were 10 years old when it started. So not only am I now old enough to be kind of teaching the undergrad, there are now like historians, like genuine academic historians training, who the reason they got into academia is because Horrible Histories inspired them when they were 10. And of course, the reason I got into history is because Maid Marian and Her Merry Men inspired me when I was 10, probably. So it's sort of nice to see that circle. It's really lovely to have played a small part in seeing a whole generation fall in love with history. But, you know, obviously it's not all me, but to be involved in that is really, really wonderful.
You're Dead to Me has been a brilliantly successful podcast, and that's designed for adults, isn't it, who don't think they're too keen on history. I love the comedy in this. It's brilliant.
Yeah, so it took us a year and a half to get off the ground, actually, funny enough. And we were going to try and do it independently, but the BBC came to us really, really late. And they were fantastically supportive, which was really lovely. But the idea behind it is my boss, Ian, who runs Moneynese Media, he said, you know, I grew up, you know, in Essex, I went to a comprehensive school. I don't feel like I got the historical education. I felt like I missed out. And I'm trying to fill in the blanks. I'm trying to read history books every weekend. I'm trying to learn it all. But there's so much stuff. And where do I start? And it sometimes feels a bit intimidating. I'd love to do a podcast for people like me. And I thought, oh, that's a brilliant idea. Yeah, absolutely. That's my whole career modus operandi, is to try and get people who, you know, fell out of love with history to fall back in love with it. And my instinct is always make things funny, make things enjoyable. But I also, having worked with comedians and comedy writers on Horrible Histories, but also I'm friends with lots of stand-up comedians, and I play football with some stand-up comedians, and so I've spent a lot of time with them. And one of the curious things about comedians is they're very similar to historians. You wouldn't think it, because they're completely different in their outlook and the way that they perform, but they're both communicators who get up in front of strangers and try to explain things in a way that they've pre-prepared, but there is also a certain element of luck and sort of, you know, interaction with the public who are in front of them. And they're both very forensic brains. Historians and comedians like to take ideas and pull them apart and go, but why? Why that? Why not this? Can we trust that? I'm not sure. I don't believe that. And so it's a really interesting thing that when you put a comedian in a room with a historian, initially they're a little bit suspicious of each other. Not suspicious, but they're a little bit slightly awkward and shy, because they're not quite, they've never been in a room with a historian, or they've never been in a room with a comedian. So occasionally, sort of the beginning of the program is a little bit sort of quieter. But what's amazing, absolutely every time we've done the show, is by the end of it, they're having a brilliant time, and I don't even have to say anything, because they are talking to each other, because they've recognised that the other one has a very similar brain to them. And it's really, really fun, because the comedian gets to be silly, but also to ask the questions that the audience at home are wanting to ask. You know, the comedian is there as the proxy to stand in for our listeners, and the historian is there to communicate brilliant, cutting-edge, university-level information and knowledge. You know, we're very highbrow, so we are delivering the same level of information you would get from In Our Time on Radio 4, but we're doing it with silly jokes and, you know, laughter and having a silly time as well. So what happens is that people kind of relax into the show. They enjoy it. They laugh. They come to it perhaps because the comedian is someone they like, you know, so you get people like Sarah Pascoe and Richard Herring. We've had, you know, amazing comedians on, Joel Dommett. Really, really famous, really funny, brilliant people. And so maybe the guests invite in a certain new audience who wouldn't necessarily listen to a historian. But almost every single time, by the end of it, the listeners are hooked on what the historian is saying. And by the end of it, you often get people tweeting in saying, this historian is fantastic. I'm going to read their book. I'm going to look them up. I'm going to, you know, we've had people saying, I'm going to study at that university. And that is so rewarding. It's so lovely when the historian becomes the star of the show. And often, because every person on the show has to have a PhD minimum, they're often academics, and they're not necessarily used to being the star of the show. They're not used to being funny, and they're not used to being in an environment where they're having to explain things and someone is making jokes back at them. But they all really enjoy it because we take them seriously. Even though we're laughing, we actually are really listening. We're really enjoying it. And we have a little quiz at the end where you get 10 questions. And the comedians always get really good scores. They always get 8, 9, sometimes 10 out of 10 because they've been listening, because it's so interesting. So I'm incredibly proud of the show because it allows the historian to be the star a bit, but it also gives comedians room to be curious. And those are the two most important things, I think.
We've got a lovely little excerpt that I think really illustrates everything you've said there perfectly. This comes from an episode where you're talking about the Olympics and in ancient Greece. And it's with classicist Professor Michael Scott in History Corner and comedian Shappi Kosandi in Comedy Corner. So here we go.
So, I mean, are the Olympic Games a religious festival? Are they a political thing? Is it just sort of, you know, a nice thing to do in the summer holidays? What's the purpose of them?
Yeah, I mean, the other massive difference in the Olympics today is that they were in a religious event. They take place in a religious sanctuary sacred to Zeus, king of the gods, and also with a bit of Pelops worship going on. In fact, there were 70 different religious altars across the sanctuary and games places at Olympia. And even worse than that, the Olympics took place over 5 days in antiquity. Pretty much the first 2.5 days were entirely religious sacrifices, religious prayers, processions, all of that jazz in honor of the gods. So nothing that took place at Olympia was not completely part of a religious process.
So there was a sort of opening ceremony, but it was a religious one.
Absolutely.
And it took 2 days.
Took two days.
And it culminated in the sacrifice of 100 oxen to Zeus.
So wow. Coldplay couldn't follow that, could they?
Shappi.
Yes.
The Olympic Games isn't, technically speaking, the straight translation. It's Olympia koi agnos was the Greek. Do you want to guess what agnos might mean in Greek?
Games?
No,
agnos, the Olympic competition.
Nearly.
It's tournament.
It's sort of agonies, isn't it? It's agonies. Kind of, it's really intense struggles.
Yeah. So they expected death.
It's full on, isn't it?
It's the agon, yeah. It's the contest, it's the competition, it's the struggle, it's the kind of, it's the thing that makes life worthwhile for your ancient Greeks. I don't know why I've gone into countryside sort of Dorset Cornwall-esque, but, you know, kind of, there we go.
Now, there were some naughty bits about tying up parts of man's anatomy during the games to prevent wobble, but we've come in a little bit after that. I mean, humour is so key. Have you ever thought of stand-up comedy yourself? Because clearly you're as passionate about comedy as you are history.
I'm just not as funny as a comedian. I land in a strange no man's land in that I'm God, this is going to sound awful. So I'm known as funny brackets for a historian, close brackets, in that the stand-up comedians I'm friends with are like, well, you're not as funny as us, clearly. But the historians I'm friends with are like, oh, you're funny. So I'm neither funny enough to be a comedian nor serious enough to be a sort of straight up historian. But I have done a little bit of stand-up. I did improv comedy at university. I wrote comedy sketches at university, and I write on horrible histories a bit as well. So I've written probably 30 or 40 of the sketches and 3 of the songs, which is, you know, great fun. But when I do book talks, I put jokes in them, you know. So I do write jokes, and I do jokes as part of my public performance. So when I go up on stage at a book festival, you know, the idea is to do a 50-minute talk where hopefully I'm getting probably 10 big laughs. That's the idea. So that's different to most other historians, I suppose, but it's different to most comedians who are looking to get 80 to 100 laughs. You know, they're looking to get a punchline every minute, and I'm looking to get a punchline every 4 or 5 minutes because I'm looking to try to mostly to focus on communicating the information and then to try and get a bit of a laugh so that everyone relaxes and has a nice time. So I'm just not as funny as a proper comedian, but I love working with comedians. I love hanging around with them. And I think, I suppose, a bit like them, and I know how to write jokes. I know how to do gags, but I'm just not as good at it. So my skill set, I suppose, is that I'm different to most historians, and that gives me something else to I can hang my hat on. But if I was actually to go and try it out as a stand-up, I'm sure I would die on my backside very quickly.
Oh, no. The image a lot of people have of historians is, you know, really studious types, knee-deep in dusty old books in antiquated libraries. But you've really brought it into the 21st century with a real awareness of how social media and podcasting can get your subject across in a fun and entertaining but obviously accurate way to millions, leaving us wanting more. Is this a really good time to be a historian, do you think, because of how accessible it is now to everybody and how you can get it across?
Oh, absolutely. It's a wonderful, wonderful time to be a historian. There are literally thousands of historians on Twitter. They use the hashtag Twitterstorian if you want to go see what they're saying. And what's so good about it, what's so brilliant, is that historians are not the sort of snooty-nosed ivory tower snobs that they've often been described as. You know, I think 30 years ago, maybe that might have been slightly more true, but probably not fair. But these days, most historians are in their 40s or even 30s. They are people who grew up with pop culture. They enjoy movies and telly and music. They like stand-up comedy. They like hip-hop. You know, like most historians now are normal people, like the rest of us. They're not people in tweed, you know. So I think the first thing to say is that, you know, I might be perhaps more public-facing than the academics and the universities, but actually I'm not really that different. And it's a fantastic time because, as you say, the ability to be able to communicate in so many different platforms is really exciting. So we can do podcasts, we can do Twitter, we can do Facebook, we can do blogging, we can go on Instagram and TikTok. You know, there are historians on TikTok. So that's really lovely. And it also means that if people have questions, if politicians are saying things about the past which are untrue, you can get an immediate response from a historian who can say, no, that's not true. And what's so good about that is it used to be that, you know, if a politician would say something, a journalist would have to know who to ask. They would, you know, if a journalist wanted to fact check it, they'd have to go, oh, who am I going to ask? Who can answer that and see if that's true? Whereas now, a politician might say something that is controversial or untrue or unfounded or a myth, and Twitter will bring that false information to the journalist because it will trend, because a historian will put it out there and go, well, that's not true, here's why, here's several points in a long thread on Twitter, and people start retweeting it and sharing it, and within an hour or so journalists will see that. So what's incredible, what's fascinating, and what's so enjoyable at the moment is that, you know, we've been living through a real crisis period in terms of politics and public health and all sorts for the past, well, certainly right now, but the past 4 years, 5 years. But what it's meant is that historians have been plugged in to national conversations because so many journalists are on Twitter and so many historians are on Twitter, they keep finding each other. So it's been a really positive thing that expertise, people who've spent their life trying to understand the nuances and complexities of the past, are able to very quickly say, no, didn't happen like that, that's a myth, that's propaganda, or that's a very broad simplification of a very complicated idea, here's what happened, here's what we know, here's why that's wrong. And so we very often are seeing now, next day newspapers are full of stuff that's been happening on Twitter the day beforehand, and I've often been involved in those kind of conversations, but it's really reassuring and rewarding to know that thanks to technology, experts, you know, not just historians, of course, scientists too, you know, virologists, epidemiologists. It means that there is a really ongoing conversation happening on these platforms that's happening for free, and people are giving their time for free because they care about the truth. They care about these facts being in the public domain. So it's a really healthy and wonderful thing, and I feel very privileged to be part of it.
How will history look back, do you think, and judge the COVID-19 period of self-isolation and everything that everybody's been going through over the last few months? And I wonder what you think we might learn from it as well.
It's such a difficult question to answer because we can only really look back when the dust has sort of settled. And what historians do is, you know, we tend to work with evidence that is not immediately available in the present. You know, I would say, for example, that history for me starts 25 years ago. Anything more recent than that feels to me like current affairs, feels like journalism. And the reason that that's, for me, that feels true, and, it, you know, some might contest it, but I think that part of what we do as historians is we get to the kind of nub of stuff once people have started to retire or perhaps die, or things get declassified, files are released because they're no longer pertinent, they're no longer dangerous, and you then start to go, oh, that's what happened. Whereas in the moment, we have too many people with careers ongoing. You know, they can't be honest. They can't be open. They can't say what's really happening. We don't get the minutes of what's happening in the Cabinet Office. So one of the challenges of knowing how the future will judge us right now is we don't know what future historians will have access to, and we don't necessarily know what will be going on in their lives, because historians are undoubtedly influenced by what's happening in their own life. You know, we all have our own cultural interests. We all have our own biases and interests and things that fascinate us and things we want to understand. So in 25, 50 years, what will people make of this era? It's hard to know. But undoubtedly, we are living through an extraordinary moment. The word unprecedented is being chucked around an awful lot, and I'm trying not to use it too much, but it really is unprecedented. We haven't had anything like this before. We've had pandemics, we've had plagues, we've had all sorts of terrifying diseases, but we've never had anything where there's been a kind of lockdown that the entire economy has been put on hold, and also where the Chancellor has gone, okay, we're going to pay people's wages. That's not been done before. And we've never had a society that is so shut down on the one hand and yet so open on the other, thanks to technology. You know, Wi-Fi, Zoom, the way we're talking to each other right now has never been achievable before. So there is no real way to say, well, you know, history tells us this will happen, because history is not a guiding light here. History can give us small little inklings of what happened in the past. We can look at, for example, you know, how Venice or Florence shut down in the 1630s when plague came to town. We can look at Spanish flu in 1919. We can look at, you know, sweating sickness in the 16th century, or the Athenian plague in the 5th century BCE. But we don't really have any kind of parallel for what we're going through right now, because what we're going through right now is totally unprecedented and new. And our experiences of it will be shaped by the technology which allows us to communicate and feel connected. But at the same time, we're also going through an economic transition that the effects of it will not be felt for years to come. We are probably in 10 years' time going to work out what really happened to our economy. So it feels very strange as a historian to kind of watch this all happening unfold, because I know that in the future, we'll be able to look back on this and go, wow, okay, that was enormously significant. But at the moment, I don't know where we're going. I have no idea what's happening tomorrow. And I wake up every day scared and nervous and confused like the rest of us. So I don't have profound wisdom. You know, looking back into past doesn't necessarily help me look forward into the future.
Greg, it's been an absolute pleasure to have a romp through history and your world today. Thank you so much. And it really is great that you're enthusing those of us who never thought history was their thing. You've certainly got me hooked on your podcast. So thank you so much for finding time in your study.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure to chat.
That was Greg Jenner, public historian, author, broadcaster, chief nerd and thoroughly good bloke. Do check out Greg's podcasts, You're Dead to Me and Homeschool History, his new book, and if you want some daily entertainment, give him a follow on Twitter. Thanks very much for listening. I'll be back with another fine guest next week, so if you've enjoyed this podcast, please tell your friends. They can find us at convex.podbean.com or go to the Convex Conversation on Spotify, Apple and Google Podcasts. Bye for now.